yes, I will note. Ah, here we go. He's back in the US. This is
Philosophy for the People with Ben Burgess and Stephen Bertram.
Yeah, I like the way that we started with, I think, a couple of fake outs for intro songs before the real one. I think it worked. You know, it felt a little bit like something that might be like a gimmicky thing for the beginning of some like Marvel multiverse thing that they'd show you like three different versions of the opening credits.
Important question: What fruit is this? Is this a black currant? A blackberry? Another black?
You are asking the wrong person.
You don't know your fruits.
I do not know my fruits.
Okay, well, don't know your fruits. I feel like
strawberries, your bananas, your classic all-American fruits. There's black currants, shit like that.
You don't know stuff that grows on British bushes?
No, not whatsoever.
So, Ben, you don't know your fruit, but do you know your great filters?
My what now?
Your great filters. Your great filters are kind of... why don't we see just loads of aliens in the sky, right? That's Fermi's paradox. And the great filters are the things which explain it.
Awesome. I already like it. Tell me more.
Well, there might be a great filter where life is really hard.
Oh, okay, I see.
Or there might be a great filter where sapience is very hard. Or there might be a great filter where agriculture is very hard. Or not killing yourself in a nuclear apocalypse is very hard. Or not getting killed by like other alien species throwing relativistic weapons at you from across space might be really hard. I just wanted to know if you had I guess you don't, but maybe you have one off the top of your head. Your idea of kind of what is the main thing that stops proliferation?
Yeah, this is... the terminology is new to me. Many years ago, I remember my friend Mark suggesting that the solution to Fermi's paradox, so, just for anybody who's not familiar with this, basically you make some pretty conservative assumptions about, like, let's say life is something that pops up every now and again around the universe. It could be pretty rare. And even within that, it could be pretty rare for it to, there to be intelligent life, that it could evolve towards intelligence, technology, that a small percentage that, ones that have developed advanced technology, were interested in space exploration, et cetera. Like you go through like several of these things, and again, starting with a very low base rate of the number of inhabited planets. And it's like, now you should still expect, that we would have run into some, right? That it's still deeply weird that we have it,
Right, if you take like a tiny cross-section of the Milky Way galaxy, there's way more stars in it than there are humans that have ever lived.
Right, exactly. So it's like, you could have a tiny percentage of these be inhabited, and a tiny percentage of those get to the point where they have spacefaring technology, et cetera. And, it should still be like some like 1980s TV show where like, there are just like constantly different alien species that you run into all the time.
Even if you have the objection that kind of we wouldn't see, how would we know that someone else has spacecraft because it's almost impossible to travel between systems? We'll still be able to see them doing fucky shit with their sun. If they start to enclose their sun in, I've forgotten the word for the perfectly normal, ordinary thing that you extract energy from the sun, solar panels. If they cover their star over a process of years or whatever with solar panels, that is exactly the thing that we could detect for hundreds of light years.
Yeah. So that's Fermi's paradox, which is not really a paradox, just kind of an objection to the idea that there's alien life out there, or that it's that it's anything but just almost non-existent, this great filter terminology I hadn't heard before. I got excited when you brought it up because I misinterpreted it in a fun way. We'll get to that in a second. But the uh, But years and years ago, I remember my friend Mark suggesting, you know, essentially a great filter idea, which is that the solution to Fermi's paradox was that the universe was just littered with singularity suicides, that once they got up to the point where they had advanced technology, they had these like great intellectual breakthroughs. They realized that life was meaningless and they collectively offed themselves. That's a Mark joke, you know, just to give you a sense of the guy, but, you know, maybe not entirely a joke anyway. The way I was understanding great filter is that there's like, there really are like tons of aliens, but like somehow or another, there's like, this is some kind of ad hoc mechanism for like why we don't see them, that, you know, that they're like filtered out. Period somehow.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that is a solution to the Fermi's paradox, is that alien life is actually very common, but we're like in space prison.
Yeah, exactly.
And actually everything we see outside of the solar system is kind of just like a reflective mirror or like a big television screen or whatever. My preferred great filter is like between sapience and civilization. Because sapience is quite common on Earth, and it's common. Mm-hmm. For instance, you know, it's not just that it's not from a single line of mammalian sapiens. We've got strong evidence that, say, crows are sapient. So it seems that sapiens emerges, at least on Earth, quite often, and it's the only data we have, quite often, alongside life. But it's really hard, I think, to get from sapiens to civilization, not just because of other factors, but you need the right body plan. Like, mm-hmm. I think that even in the absence of us, non-kind of monkey-based mammalian species and birds would really struggle to make civilization because they don't have the right kind of body plan. And you can say, well, evolution would select for that, but I don't really see why that's true. I don't think evolution selects for civilization in any sense of kind of before civilization. Which is, we say all this because someone, some kind of American Air Force official who's meant to know lots of things, has come out and said, well, actually, not just are there lots of aliens out there, but they've come visited Earth, the Vatican specifically, unlike DeSantis, who's never been.
Yes, there you go. Yeah. This guy David Grush is a whistleblower in maybe not in the colloquial sense of like somebody's telling the truth about government secrets.
You're saying something.
That's sort of the issue in dispute. But is a whistleblower in the legal sense, that he's like gone through, you know, this process that's set up for whistleblowers to avoid like legal punishment, you know, for divulging state secrets, that he's like that he's sort of which means that like this is kind of the excuse for a lot of things we're going to get into, that, you know, he can't just directly divulge things to the public because then they'd throw him in prison.
But also like it seems the US throws a lot of people in prison regardless of how exactly they go about their whistleblowing, so
this is, I mean, he's trying to do this quote unquote the right way, you know, through the
because he's being advised by like US government lawyers how to do it.
Yeah, through the legally established process. So we should say this guy, and as far as I know, we'll get into, you know, kind of how he came on my radar, and, you know, and I want to admit the limits of my knowledge about this, but as far as I can tell, nobody particularly denies that this guy is who he claims to be, or that he's had this very impressive career. So he was an Air Force officer, and sort of through the Air Force, he ended up going into basically like, you know, the Air Force's contribution to the tangled web of what's sometimes called the intelligence community, that the sort of national security state and various overlapping, you know, agencies and task forces and whatever that are involved in looking at secret information. And, you know, for, you know, originally, you know, counterterrorism kinds of purposes is what it sounds like. But ultimately, he ended up being appointed to one of these government task forces, of which there are several now, various agencies to look at UAPs.
So they gave him the aliens job and he's leaked it. Like, that was his whole thing.
Yeah, more or less, right? So so UAP...
Yeah, that, I was already at like 99% sus, but that obviously puts it to 100. Like, obviously that means he's been told to say what he's been said.
Perhaps. So so that's... UAP is an unidentified aerial phenomenon, which obviously means exactly the same thing as an unidentified flying object, but at this point, you know, UFO has embarrassing associations. So so all the bureaucratic agencies switched from UFO to UAP as their preferred designation. You know, it's a little bit like the, you know, the euphemism treadmill, you know, for yes. terms that used to be just like neutral clinical terms that become slurs. And then you have to come up with a new term, and then all the negative associations, you know, shift to that. And, you know, I'm sure eventually UAP will become enough of a punchline that they'll have to come up with something else. But yeah, so he was so he was leading one of these UAP task forces, like the geospatial something something, you know, UAP portfolio. And then he claims that he came into possession of this information, you know, that, you know, this is the part that, you know, whether he's telling the truth about any of this is much more controversial. So to be really clear on his claim, he doesn't say that he's personally seen any aliens. He says, what he says, though, is that, you know, right, he was in charge for this geospatial whatever of investigating, you know, reports, but then it turns out that, you know, he says he came into possession of this information. Actually, you know, the deep state basically has been in possession of multiple partial and whole recovered crash landed, you know, alien spacecrafts for forever. And I think in the possession also of like live aliens at various points. And that they have been hiding this, even from Congress, for decades. And he says that he, you know, like he talked to people, he saw documents, and it's a little unclear what evidence he's claiming to have of all this. But he claims that he started out as a hardcore skeptic and became a believer, and that he says that he's sort of trying to, you know, go through the bureaucratic process to find out more, and the door was slammed in his face. And then he, you know, started to, you know, and then he's like, you know, becoming a very cautious whistleblower, you know, that, so he, which basically means like, you don't get permission to talk to the public. That's, you know, you can't do that. Right. But you have a, but you can sort of declare yourself a whistleblower and at least talk to Congress behind closed doors. And so he's done that. And then there was this article about him. And, you know, I do want to look, I'm not, I don't want to bury the lead here. My own view on all of this is that it's bullshit, but but to give the people who give this more credit than I do, they're due. So the fact that this guy does have this like very impressive background, and that people that he's making much more specific claims than people who say things like this usually do. None of that seems to be in dispute. And it's also to his credit, the reporters who broke this story, you know, Ralph Blumenthal, as far as I know, no relation to the Gray Zone Blumenthal, is, but this guy was like a staff reporter for the New York Times for decades. And he's not just like a random crazy person with a website. And
as we know, US intelligence officers don't lie for a living. so we know that he's trustworthy.
Yeah, I mean, there is definitely, I mean, look, there's the obvious second order conspiracy theory here that might be true. I think it's that one's a lot more plausible than the first order conspiracy theory. But yeah, so I found out about all this from a segment on the program Breaking Points, Crystal Ball and Sagar and Jetty. For anybody who didn't want to watch Breaking Points, it's a news and analysis and commentary show where it's the Crystal, you know, Crystal's a leftist, Sagar's kind of a right winger. I don't know exactly what he thinks, but whatever. They have, and in, well, but I do know what he thinks about this, right? So, so in this segment, right, Sagar did this segment about it on the show, and Crystal, I think, made some very well-founded skeptical points about whether this guy was on the level. And what basically inspired the post, the essay for the Substack, is that this sort of back and forth between Crystal and Sagar about whether to believe this guy, or, you know, I don't know if Sagar is quite on the, you know, I mean, he did say a few times, you know, I believe he's not crazy and stuff like that. You know, they, I think that this back and forth between them about how credible to find any of this really powerfully reminded me of David Hume's argument about miracles in chapter 10 of The Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding. And it's not one-to-one, not everything transfers, but a lot of what he says about the reasons not to believe in testimony about alleged miracles that people have seen would also apply to why you shouldn't believe this guy, even if he claimed, which he doesn't, to have personally seen the aliens.
It'd be funny if he isn't kind of like an op, like he genuinely believes it, but it is in fact an op.
That's also entirely possible that there's a version of the second order conspiracy theory where he's part of the victim. He's a victim of the conspiracy. Like this guy is, you know, this guy is Fox Mulder in his head, but
yeah,
like
he's just been drip fed a load of bullshit for years.
Well, it's like, yeah, they're just patiently waiting for him to have the epiphany as he puts it together.
Yeah, they were probably getting quite annoyed he was taking so long. But to talk about philosophy,
yeah,
there's a fun example which is used, and one I think can be abused even more, that Hume gives about kind of the difference between believing water can freeze if you're from somewhere where water doesn't freeze, compared to someone that was walking on water. But I didn't quite get kind of what the fundamental distinction between those two things were and why you should kind of be credible about one and not about the other. So yeah, if you could kind of go into that, I think it's a fun example.
Yeah, so...
because obviously the interesting thing is that you can walk on frozen water, right?
Yeah. So yeah, the walking on water here means walking on water in its liquid state. So the Hume brings up this example about, he says, a prince in India who, you know, remember this, you know, Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding is published in 1748. So, you know, much harder to get detailed information across, great distances and, you know, no photographs, etc. So this Indian prince who Hume says, didn't believe, reports he'd heard about frost, freezing, right? You know, and Hume's point is, so there's a way that he thinks that example is different from the miracle examples. There's a way that he thinks that it's the same. The way that he thinks that it's the same is, he's like, look, this guy was right to be skeptical. He should have been skeptical. Right? He should, like, you shouldn't just believe somebody, you know, who reports to you, oh, look at this thing I saw that has absolutely no analogy in your experience and, you know, doesn't obviously seem like the way that the world should work and all that. It's like, oh, okay, right? I guess that's true. You should have
listened to the lived experiences of British people.
That's exactly. I love that phrase, by the way, because I'm always so curious about what kind of experience is being contrasted to.
Yeah, what are the unlived experiences? Is that like when you're on loads of ketamine?
Yeah. But it's like, yeah, you should, you know, he was right to be initially skeptical. You should demand like a fair amount of evidence before you believe this. But he thinks that the threshold for believing in frost, if you spend your entire life in a tropical climate in the 1700s, is still lower than the threshold for believing in actual miracles like walking on water in its liquid state. And the distinction that he makes between the two is that it's not that the Indian prince observed water get really, really, you know, like go to these temperatures, down to these temperatures and not freeze, right? It's not that he had some reason to believe that this was a violation of the laws of nature. Like there was nothing in his experience that would tell him one way or the other what would happen to water at that temperature. Whereas we all have tons of experience about how, you know, liquid and solid things interact. So Hume uses this phrase a lot about the constant conjunction of experiences, that no matter how many times you try something, you know, the same thing always results every time, right? So
this relates to like Humean's idea of how the laws of nature work, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where the laws of nature are like, I've actually forgotten the phrase, but like consistent systems where the same thing happens over and over again.
Yeah. I think how Hume's views that he'll sometimes express about how to understand natural laws relate to the use that he'll put natural laws in cases like this miracles argument or some of what he says about determinism is an interesting question. 99.9% of the time you should ignore what British people tell you, but you know, every now and again, you know, it's like the Simpsons, you know, hey, remember when, you know, we all learned to ignore grandpa? Well, you should listen to him now. So his core point about miracles, he makes a bunch of secondary points, some of which are also relevant to the UAP case, and some of which aren't. But his core point is that we have a lot of evidence that the laws of physics work the way that we think they do. That, again, every, you know, anything that's a basic natural law, like every single time, it always happens that way. Like, so we just have a tremendous pile of evidence confirming that, you know, the way water works is if, you know, you put your foot down on top of it in its liquid state, you know, it'll sink into the water in that example, or that, you know, people don't come back from the dead. That's an example that Hume likes a lot, that, you know, he uses several times in that chapter. And
very edgy thing to say at the time, considering an important guy did it.
Yeah. I should say, I don't mention this in the essay, but at the end of the chapter, he does this very awkward look. I'm not saying you shouldn't believe Christianity. I don't know where you're getting that idea. But sure, go for it, right? You know.
I remember in high school philosophy class, my teacher, cause I went to Catholic school, made fun of Hume for not coming out as an atheist. And even at the time, I was like, come on. Like, he didn't do it because, like, I don't know if you would have gone to jail, but like it would have been fun.
Yeah, I'm not totally sure what would have happened to somebody who just out and said that in the 1740s, but I'm pretty sure nothing good.
Especially in Scotland, they used to be insane about Christianity back then.
Yeah, it's where all the hardcore Calvinists were. I think
you're trying to do something horrible like moving to England.
Exactly. I wasn't going to do that. Come on. I also don't think that his occasional half-hearted. Yeah, I mean, obviously, Chris Jericho. Anyway, moving on. I don't think that confused anybody. I think everybody was pretty clear what he thought. But I also think that he was probably, you know, I mean, he actually says in one of his letters when he was talking about one of the, actually the first thing I ever wrote a Substack essay about, the his essay about the afterlife. It wasn't the afterlife, the one on suicide, right? It was those two, the suicide essay and the heaven and hell essay in his four essays. He says in the letter that he originally had included them in the book, and then he left them out of an abundance of prudence. I think that's pretty direct evidence about that point. But yeah, the fact that nobody comes back from the dead is something that is attested to by all experience of anybody ever. The evidence for this is just totally overwhelming. And so if somebody says, hey, I saw somebody come back from the dead, even if that person seems really trustworthy, what you have to do is you have to weigh two things. One is the probability of a person who seems really trustworthy lying or being crazy or whatever, right? You know, and two is the probability that somebody would come back from the dead. And
this extends even to like your own perceptual experience. Like if I saw something miraculous happen with my own eyes, I still wouldn't believe it had happened.
Yeah. I think that does seem to follow from what he's saying. I mean, it's not a consequence he personally draws out. So I want to be a little careful about not attributing it to him, but I think that like, this seems like the same structure of the argument would probably work. Whether or not the person who sees it with their own eyes is justified, certainly he doesn't think you're justified on the basis of secondhand testimony. Because it's just, however improbable it might seem that the person who seems to have a lot of integrity would lie to you, it's much more improbable that somebody would come back from the dead. I mean, that's the intuitive core of the argument.
Right. You know, I've been lied to plenty of times in my life. Yes. I haven't seen anyone come back from the dead or walk on water or be an alien.
Yeah, exactly. Probably even been lied to a few times by people who really seem to be on the level as they did it. Exactly. And I think the thing that's maybe important to really clarify here is that Hume's not making a metaphysical argument. He's not making an argument for the impossibility of people coming back from the dead or walking on water or, you know, just in general, you know, reality not working the way that we think it does. That's not the argument he's making. He's making an epistemic argument. In other words, he's making an argument against the rationality of believing in miracles on the basis of testimony, saying that that this would not so Shani's comment about the woman who woke up in her wake. Hume actually comes pretty close to directly addressing that later in the chapter. I don't quote this part of the essay, but he's going through some hypotheticals about cases in which we could have like really, really good evidence for an apparent miracle. And part of his point is that like all the existing cases, our evidence is terrible. He points out at the dawn of religions when the miracle stories are first being reported, the religion isn't a big enough deal for anybody to bother debunking it at the time. And then by the time it's important enough that you bother, like everybody who'd be in a position to contradict the original story is long since dead. And he points
yeah,
out.
Yeah, like the Romans recorded Jesus' execution, but they didn't bother recording that like 12 peasants were saying, actually.
Exactly. And, you know, he makes the point, and, you know, this is one I should say, to be fair, does not transfer to the alien case, that insofar as different religions are making inconsistent claims, whatever evidence...
This does sound like it applies in the case of aliens, so not specifically for this alien story, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I was just saying, you know, if religion A and religion B can't both be true, they're making inconsistent claims about reality, then whatever evidence the miracle story is offered by religion A provide for religion A are canceled out by the evidence that the miracle stories of religion B apply for religion B, in just the same way that two witnesses at a trial who seem equally reliable cancel each other out if one of them says the defendant was at the scene of the crime and the other says they were with him, you know, miles away. It's like, well, you know, if you can't judge between them, then you know, you just kind of have to disregard both of them. So he says that, generally speaking, our evidence for alleged miracles is terrible. That for a variety of reasons, that like it's, you know, it's usually like thousands of years too late to really look into it. You know, there are all sorts of reasons he thinks that it's just sort of innately implausible. That, you know, one of the things that he points out that definitely does apply to the alien case is that, you know, once the claims become more incredible, what should happen is that we become more skeptical of the claims as they diverge more dramatically from our experience. But what often happens instead is exactly the opposite, that if somebody makes like a sort of moderately ridiculous claim, you know, we're skeptical, but then once it becomes like mind blowing, then, you know, kind of want it to be true and, you know, and get some joy from, you know, repeating it.
I just submitted an article to Sublation talking about how we constantly want these like really terrible, amazing events to happen. Like everyone wanted the Wagner March to kind of end in a great explosion. But actually what we really get is just terribleness happening very slowly.
Right. Yeah, I think there's something to that. I think there's, I think that there is a sort of sense in which, you know, presumably this is not the, these are not the emotions being experienced by people like living in Moscow suburbs, but you know, watching from afar, there's the sort of sense that you get that the collective news experience is like, oh man, they took us right up to the brink of something really exciting happening, you know, and then we didn't even get follow through. We didn't get to see how the rest of the season, you know, played out.
It was really good one for me because I got to be proved like live right on Twitter. Because I said that, you know, nothing's going to happen, and then everything seemed like it was going to happen, and then in the end, nothing happened.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy that it came as close as it did. I mean,
the amazing thing is how much happened without anything actually happening, you know?
yeah, totally. I mean, I think that it's like, you know, that just the sort of structure of what happened that, you know, caterer turned mercenary turns against the official government and, you know, marches on the Capitol like some third century Roman general, and then is like, doesn't go to prison, but like they actually have to negotiate with him and, you know, at least give him a soft exit.
He sent it to exile to Belarus, which is like exiling me to Wales or something.
I can see that.
I think the important thing is, so, okay, we agree with David Hume. We shouldn't believe in miracles.
Yeah.
You want to do another thing.
Well, I was going to say, just real quickly on Shadi's point, he does consider toward the end of the chapter some cases where it's like, okay, what if the evidence was like this? And like there was like much better testimonial evidence than the testimonial evidence that we tend to have for miracles. And so he gives an example about like, okay, what if in 1600 or whatever, Yeah, Rudolf Hess, is the that that what if in 1600 or whatever Queen Elizabeth had died, and the death was proclaimed all over the country, and there was a funeral, and then a few weeks later she came back and resumed the throne, and he just kind of makes the obvious point that it's like, well, if this was something that was like attested, you know, it was like universally attested to the sequence of events, then I would believe that her death was reported. I wouldn't believe that she'd actually died. I would think that, as unlikely as this seems, I would think that she faked her death.
And also people can end up, you know, what happened in the case of this wake, this woman waking up in her wake, was that she was mostly dead, but not all the way.
Oh, well, shit. Okay, we've all seen The Princess Bride. We know they're almost dead and dead, or, you know, importantly different.
And then she did die, probably not helped by her circumstances, a few days later.
Sure, sure. Okay, so yeah, as you say, if you think that Hume is right about miracles, that the evidence that the laws of nature, like, and actually, I guess maybe it is worth just taking a second to like really sort of circle and underline the point about the laws of nature, because it's not that like, okay, if you start out believing that Jesus is the incarnate Son of God, then okay, fair enough, right? You know, walk in water, you know, take your people back from the dead, all whatever should be expected. But the point is that the chain of reason is supposed to work the other way around. It's supposed to be that the miracles are evidence that he is this, right? You know, that you didn't previously have a reason to think this, and the miracles convince you. So at this point, it's not that, oh, the incarnate Son of God did this. It's just, this guy did this, right? What should your, you know, what should your probability assessments be for this guy did this, or no, I don't think so. And you know, if, you know, given that we have this uniform experience that's confirmed by, you know, garden variety day-to-day experience, you know, constantly, and, you know, more rigorous experimentation and blah, 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 right? We have just this mountain of evidence that the laws of nature work the way that we think that they do. It's not that we just reserve judgment about each new case of somebody, you know, of somebody, when somebody dies, like, oh, will this person stay dead? Guess we'll have to wait and see, right? You know, it's like, no, you just assume in any random case, it could be that you've never heard of somebody before, the first thing you find out about them is that they're dead. You will be very confident that they're not coming back. And that confidence is rooted in that giant mountain of evidence that the laws of nature work the way that we think they do. And, you know, testimonial evidence is good for, you know, it's not like it has no value, that, you know, it's like there are lots of things that we believe because people tell us that they happen. This has some value, but it's just somebody who seems very sane and very honest saying something that's not true for whatever reason, that, you know, that they're lying, that they are not nearly as sane as they think they seem to be, that somebody tricked them, whatever the case may be, right? That however unlikely that seems, it's not nearly as unlikely as somebody walking in water coming back from the dead. So that's Hume's argument about miracles. The question is, how similar is this UFO or UAP case? And I think pretty similar.
Because it's interesting, because I spoke as in order to establish at the start of the show that we both think aliens are actually very, very likely. But we think it's miraculous that they would have come to Earth, or like, what's the big step here?
Yeah. I don't know how likely aliens are. I mean, I think it's an interesting question. Like the sort of, are there aliens out there somewhere? Question is, yeah, it's, I think there's some obvious reasons to think yes. You know, that, well, yeah, exactly. Right. The universe is very big. So there is this like obvious probabilistic reason to come on. There must be some out there somewhere. Although what we started with, was the reason to think no, right? That that you know where are they now? Of course, I suppose if David Grush is telling the truth, and in fact you know Benito Mussolini's government in Italy recovered an alien spacecraft in the 30s. And somehow Vatican back channels, whatever the fuck he thinks happened, there, you know, that ended up being transported to the US after the war. And there are several other alien spacecrafts that have come into our possession, and et cetera, et cetera. If all that's true, then never mind all that Fermi stuff, I suppose. But yeah, I think that before we bring that in, I think the Fermi stuff gives us at least some reason to think no. The sort of obvious probability point gives us some reason to think yes. You know, I guess I'll just say maybe. You know that that there could well be aliens out there somewhere. But you know the problem about the aliens, the alien ships crash landing in you know rural Italy or you know wherever this is happening. Is more the sheer distances that they would have to be traveling from, because one thing that, you know, I mean, part of the whole Fermi thing is
that that's the counterpoint to big is big.
Yeah, exactly. The part of the Fermi thing is like, look, one thing we're pretty sure of is that there are no aliens anywhere near us, right? Like, the sort of local neighborhood around Earth, and I don't just mean like the solar system, like a much bigger local neighborhood. We've checked that pretty thoroughly, and it really doesn't seem like there's. I mean, you know, maybe under the ice in Europa, there's some you know there's some fish or something, but I'm not you know fish like on Earth, but whatever you know they have a, but like maybe there's something. But we're pretty confident that there's at least no high-tech alien civilizations anywhere close to us. That they would have to be coming from very, 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 very far away.
There's an interesting point here with Europa. So we've actually dispatched a spacecraft to go to Europa to check it for life. But to go just to Europa, it's going to take 13 years.
Yeah. Well, this... And this goes to the point, right?
Yeah.
That's Europa. And look, whatever might or might not be there, one thing we're pretty sure that there are not are the kind of aliens who have spaceships. That's like, that is not really on the table, right? They would have to be much, much, much further away. So like, it seems like these ships crash land in rural Italy would have had to have, given the sheer distances involved, would have had to have traveled at the speed of light, which would be, you know, at least according to, you know, our best current physics, is impossible, would violate the laws of nature. David Grush has speculated in at least one interview I saw by him that they're not from distant planets, they're from alternate universes. But
it doesn't help you, bud.
That's not going to help, because again, at least according to our best current scientific understanding of all this stuff, if there is a multiverse, the walls are closed, right? You know, there's no, it's every bit as physically impossible to travel between different universes as it is to travel faster than the speed of light within our universe. So it seems like, in fact, much like walking on water, resurrection from the dead, that these alien ships get into Earth would violate the laws of nature. Now, we could be wrong about what laws of nature are. That's always possible. But I don't think the Humean argument here relies on being an infallibilist about the laws of nature. That, you know, it's not that, like, obviously scientific revolutions happen. we, you know, Newton to Einstein was one, and perhaps Einstein to somebody who can explain how one of these things are actually possible, though they seem impossible.
Right, but so let's imagine that they do have faster than light travel due to some kind of amazing physics. They've managed to leave their own solar system, probably go to others, get into ours, get through our asteroid belt, pilot through the gravity of Jupiter and the large gas giants, not get sucked into the sun, and they get to Earth and they just crash into fucking Italy. That's the thing that really bothers me.
That'd be so sad. If any
alien species can get to Earth from some other solar system, they're going to pilot Italy fine. If they slammed into an Italian mountain, it would be the mountain that suffered, not them.
So, I will say there was a argument that's at the available. If you look at the Daily Wire YouTube channel, Matt Walsh is a big believer in the aliens visiting us. Ben Shapiro, it's, you know, the 1% of things that he's right about is pretty skeptical. And so there's a video where they're arguing about it, and I think Shapiro was trying to make the argument you just made, but I don't think he makes it as well. So it's like really unclear what his point is. So I think that's a good point. I think in addition to that, two basic things. One is, yeah, sure, maybe our best current science is wrong about how physical reality works. You know, maybe faster than light travel or, you know, interdimensional travel is possible. We're just wrong. That's fine. Hume's point doesn't rely on like somehow being able to rule that out a priori. Because again, he's not making a metaphysical argument, he's making an epistemic argument. He's not making an argument about, oh, reality could only work this one way, not this other way. He's making an argument about what it's rational to believe based on our current evidence. It's not that science is infallible. It's that there is a lot of evidence that physical reality works the way that we think it does. Like the satellites that, you know, allow, you know, the phone in your pocket to tell time have to be adjusted for like small relativistic effects. They're like the evidence that Einsteinian relativity is true is just overwhelming. Again, maybe we'll be surprised. But right now we have this huge mountain of evidence to support it. And the fact that this Air Force guy seems really credible, right? Like all the sorts of things that Sagar was saying in this conversation with Crystal, that he seems like a very credible guy, that there are these veteran reporters who've talked to a lot of crazy people and he doesn't seem crazy to them and blah, 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 blah. Fine. Let's just accept all that. None of that, like the improbability of this guy who seems really credible, being wrong, right? Like having been duped himself or duping us for whatever reason, or just being crazy, even though he doesn't seem crazy, whatever, however low you think the probability of all those scenarios added together is, like, it's not going to be the probability that this guy is telling the truth is just not going to be higher than the probability that the physical theories that we have all this evidence for are true. So that's the first point. And then the second point is like, okay, let's even assume, like, let's concoct whatever story you have to concoct to, I just haven't read the right, science fiction novels. And I don't know if there's some sort of scenario whereby we don't have to say that all of our current physical theories are wrong, but somehow,
wormholes, maybe, like white holes, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, something along
where,
those
where you,
lines.
You don't travel faster than light because you actually, like, there's bits of space which are glued together which seem far away to us but actually aren't.
Yeah, I think the way that, given what we currently know about wormholes, it doesn't, I think the sort of science fiction plot device where, we.
Well, that as opposed to stuff about being big, I think they're famously incredibly small, the real ones.
Yeah. So, but whatever. Like, let's just assume for the sake of argument that all that's wrong. There's still a version of the human point that seems pretty powerful here. Like, I mean, this is when I still teach classes for Rutgers, but I do it online. I don't live in New Jersey, but like when I lived in New Jersey and taught in-person classes there, I'd usually say something at some point in the course of talking about this chapter, like, look, you would apply something like this reasoning even in a 100% non-miraculous case of somebody just saying something really bizarre and surprising, right? Like less bizarre and surprising than Frost would be if your experience was entirely confined to tropical climates. Like, if I said, presidents Biden, Putin, and Zelensky, I don't know, also throw in the Wagner guy, maybe, have
Prigozhin.
all secretly traveled to Los Angeles to have dinner at my apartment last night, and then left in secret. Okay, the story I've told doesn't violate any laws of nature. That's all fine. It doesn't even include any like surprising new information about the laws of nature. Never mind
Or
contradicting.
any doesn't need any new technology.
Doesn't need any new technology, right? It's all, but like, still really unlikely. Like really unlikely. And even if I said this or whatever, maybe you don't think I'm trustworthy, just think of the most trustworthy person you know and have them saying this, like making the equivalent claim about wherever they live. That person pulling your leg, being like, even if it wasn't just a sort of innocent joke, if you're like, no, really, did this happen? Look me in the eye, what, like, you were. You got to the point in the conversation would have been an incredibly cruel joke if they'd persisted in it. Still, like, you still wouldn't believe them. Like, you shouldn't believe them. That's because even though there's no violation of the laws of nature, there's no new technology we don't know about in that story, there's nothing like that, it's just incredibly unlikely. And the unlikelihood of the most trustworthy person you know saying something false is still not as low as the likelihood of that story being true. And when you start looking at the Grush revelations, alleged revelations, the fact that these ships, like, again, at least one of them is supposed to have been in the custody of one government or another, originally Mussolini's and then the US since the 1930s. Right, so the better part of a century. You think that there are several other ships that are in government custody in various places that, like, also, by the way, while we're at it, don't get me wrong. I mean, governments conspire to lie to people all the time. They may well be doing it here, just not in the, not in the first
Right,
order way.
they do conspire to lie to us, but they also then, tell it to the New York Times.
Yeah, exactly, right? Like they, yeah, I mean, like sometimes they do things in secret, but then like at a top level, they still can't help themselves from bragging about it. Sometimes they try harder than that to keep it secret, but then like some like low-level, contractor, like
You've heard the Trumpian argument against aliens, right?
that Trump would have told us if they were aliens.
Yeah. Well, he necessarily wouldn't have told us. We would have told, like, Kid Rock.
Okay, that sounds right to me. Yeah, that would have been that there would be like that we would have gotten one of these cell phone videos from Mar-a-Lago. It's like, oh my God, over here, look, this is very secret. This is like the aliens. Do you see
Like, we're going to use this UFO to bomb Iran.
this?
But which, he doesn't
I mean,
necessarily
but it would have been like
exclude.
like one of those things we actually do have recordings of where he says like 10 times, like, oh no, this is illegal. I'm doing crimes right now. You know,
there really are aliens and it's illegal for me to tell you.
Yeah. And by the way, while we're at it, like just the scale of the successful conspiracy here, because again, lots of real conspiracies, most of them not very successful over the course of time and like keeping the information contained. And I suppose, you know, some most of the ones you know about, but you know, like it really seems like the track record of keeping important
inductively
stuff,
which is what we're trying to do here.
Yeah, exactly. Secret is not great. You know, you also have to start asking some secondary questions like, okay, so far we have the Italian government, the US government, and the Vatican at the very least. Those are three governments that are all keeping it secret. Do other
imagine
governments...
the amount of child prostitutes Berlusconi would have told.
And yeah, they would have gone to the Italian tabloids. Like, you know, one of the things I mentioned in the essay is like, okay, did the other side of the Cold War never get wind of this?
Right, I mean, it's the same reason that it's impossible for the US to have faked the landing on the moon. Because if they had, the Soviets would have actually done it.
I suppose we could have, there could have been some elaborate thing where both faked it and, you know, the other both wondered if the other one had really done it. But yeah, it's, this seems incredibly unlikely, even if it didn't violate any physical laws, which it seems like it would, but whatever, even if it didn't, it just seems incredibly unlikely. And it seems so incredibly unlikely that this guy who, you know, Sagar and Jetty thinks seems like a, you know, like a very serious guy who's been vetted by other very serious guys, whatever, saying something false for whatever reason. There are a lot of scenarios that could lead to him saying something false. Lying, crazy, still in fact following orders because it's some sort of weird psyop, tricked by people who are pulling some weird psyop, tricked by people who are pulling an incredibly elaborate weird prank, whatever. Like, maybe you think that
engage in a jape.
Maybe all these things seem like, you know, really unlikely to you. And maybe even when you add up all those possibilities, the sum of them still seems really unlikely to you. But like, not as unlikely as that story being true.
Ben, do you know about Hyperborea? Which I'm definitely pronouncing wrong.
Hyperborea. You know, I've heard that word before. I'm trying to place it.
Well, I mean, it was an old word used for basically like beyond the north.
Is it like the Conan stuff? Isn't that the
Hyperborean? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Hyperboreans are in Conan, but the kind of idea that kind of racists had through early modernity was that actually like white people are from the North Pole as part of this polygenesis idea. But in the contemporary age, the idea of polygenesis from like physical locations on Earth became a lot less plausible. So what contemporary Nazis suggest, and I think they actually got this originally from black nationalists, which is a great incestuous circle, is that white people are aliens.
Sure.
That white people, you know, came from a different planet, and that's the polygenesis.
Nice.
I've got a clip saved on my hard drive of Richard Spencer saying very something similar to this.
Oh yeah, that sounds like a. By the way, what happened to that guy? Like I'm sorry, I know this is completely off topic, but I saw, a month or two ago, I saw a tweet from him that really weirded me out because it's like it seems like it was the kind of thing that like. It was the kind of thing that some like, you know, I stand with Biden kind of account would have tweeted out, you know, is like he's, you know, he's super duper like pro, you know, pro Ukraine. He's like very, he seems to be pretty soft on Biden. It's like, man, they're not, They're not making Nazis like they used to.
Yeah, basically when Trump wasn't actually a white nationalist and didn't do anything for white people, which is, well, for anyone really, that didn't have a million or more dollars. Richard Spencer decided that, you know, he's bad. And actually the best hope for white people is kind of like left welfareism.
Okay.
And so he became a big Bernie guy, a big Bernie supporter. And then when Bernie lost, he became a Biden supporter. Wow. This partially is to trigger other people on the far right. You know, he's kind of like what like Haz is for the far left, for the far right, in that he takes positions that will like trigger other Nazis. But I think he is kind of, I think, genuinely like a racist social democrat.
Okay. Yeah, that all sounds about right. I do remember, actually, I think he did endorse Obama in 2008, but I think that was for accelerationist reasons. Yeah. All right. Well, the jury's out about whether white people are aliens, but, you know, the...
I can send you some insane gifts I've saved on 4chan, which I can't show to the audience.
I can see that, sure. Yeah.
I realized watching these GIFs that they are on a level of internet poisoned irony that I could not even imagine. I won't even describe them. I'll tell them after we're off air.
Yeah. No, I love that analogy about, you know, like this like, you know, Haas giving these you know, tortured Marxist explanations for why you should actually
why Starbucks is gay and Trader Joe is based.
Yeah, exactly. That it's like, and you know, you should actually support the most right-wing Republicans and whatever, that it's like the same, that it's the, you know, that there's this like weird parallel thing where it's like, no, actually, you should actually support the, you know, the like Jewish leftist candidate, you know, for like properly Nazi reasons.
Without kind of immense kind of intellectual strength and kind of theory behind you, all American politics descend into which stores, which shops, which businesses are based and which ones are cringe.
There is a lot of that. I remember like several years ago when the there was a big thing about people were boycotting, like liberals were boycotting Chick-fil-A because the owners were social conservatives who were against gay marriage and gave money to right-wing causes and stuff. And, you know, as the world continues to turn, now we've actually reached a point where there are social conservatives who are boycotting Chick-fil-A because they have, like, diversity, equity, and inclusion stuff in the company. But I remember when the first round of the Chick-fil-A stuff was going on, and so it was like you proved that you were like a good liberal by getting like KFC, I guess.
Yeah, that's the crazy thing, that Americans do seem to like boycott stores constantly. I can't imagine, like in Britain we had Wetherspoons, which is owned by the only kind of really publicly political big kind of shop owner on the high street guy. It's a chain of pubs. And he's like massively right wing. He publishes like a massive magazine, which he puts in his pubs, and like it was all massively pro Brexit and whatever. But actually, leftists love Wetherspoons. it's cheap, basically, and never called for boycott of it, including when the workers there went on strike because the workers didn't want them to call a boycott. But also, like. I don't want to flex on America, but the British left, as bad as it is generally slightly connected to trade unions. So.
Yeah, exactly, right. Well, that's what I was thinking, that it's like, I remember when the original Chick-fil-A stuff was going on, thinking that it's like, this is amazing that, you know, in a atmosphere where, you know, especially then, I mean, still now, but especially then, like the, where like, you know, any kind of working class organization was essentially a rumor from the distant past. You know, the socialism was like unheard of. I mean, I remember the original Facebook option, you know, like when you put together your Facebook profile, back in the 2000s, the options it gave you for politics were liberal, conservative, very conservative, or very liberal. So, there was the idea, it was like literally not on the table that, you know, that there was something, you know, besides very liberal, whatever, that like under, you know, all these decades of capitalist realism, you know, the idea that you could actually accomplish something through, you know, mass politics and you know, achieving state power or anything like that is totally unheard of. So it's like, yeah, you know, in this kind of environment, like that's what politics get reduced to, where you buy your chicken sandwiches. Like, you know, which one of these corporations, you know, are you going to, are you going to patronize? Just fucking awesome. And in its own way, I think I think it is its own kind of morbid symptom for anti-government-y kind of energy to get sucked in these weird conspiratorial directions.
It's probably also very related to commodity fetishism, because we imagine these like as if there's relationships between the different kinds of chicken sandwiches. Like, this is a base one, and this is a cringe one, whatever. Okay, but on next Saturday,
relations between people present themselves as relations between chicken sandwiches.
Saturday, Ben is going to be listing all of the shops, top 100 stores in America, from most base to most cringe.
Yeah, no, that's correct. That's the enough of this philosophy shit. It's time to talk about that really matter. So that's something to look forward to.
Okay, bye.